This is Jim Cotter. Welcome to our Creatively Speaking show archive. Our ability to present these programs online is supported by WRTI's listener members. If you're already a member, thanks so much. If you're not a member, why not, while you're listening, click on the Become a Member link on the left of all WRTI.org webpages. Your support is vital to ensure we can continue to produce this and all of the other programming you hear on WRTI. Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello. Efforts are now underway to keep Thomas Aiken's painting, The Gross Clinic, in Philadelphia. We'll speak with those leading the charge. Jason Pfeiffer explores the tales of Hoffman from Temple University Opera Theatre. The production is based on the newest edition of the 19th century work, which incorporates 24 previously undiscovered pages from the original score. Susan Lewis looks at a new filmmaking contest. Project 21 gives competitors just 21 days to create a completely new work, but with a twist. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.
Last week, Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia announced that its Board of Trustees had authorized the sale of Thomas Aiken's painting The Gross Clinic to the National Gallery of Art and the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Arkansas. The announcement, however, came with an escape clause. If any local art museum or governmental institution could match the agreed $68 million price tag by December 26th, then the painting would remain in the city. If, and it's a big if, such a large sum can be raised so quickly, custody of the painting would be shared by Philadelphia's two major arts institutions. In a moment, we'll hear from Don Caldwell, board chair of the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, where Thomas Aiken studied and taught, and which houses a significant collection of his work. But first to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, which inherited the artist's personal collection on the death of his widow in the 1930s. I asked museum director Anne Darnancourt why the Gross Clinic should stay in Philadelphia.
The Gross Clinic is one of the great icons of Philadelphia in a lot of ways. It's a very great work of art. It's by one of the greatest American artists of all time, from beginning to now. Aiken's is an artist, obviously, whose whole career reverberates throughout Philadelphia. It did when he was alive, and it still does now. There are so many artists who are painting and teaching in ways that are very affected by Aiken's, even though their work may not look like his. So Aiken's is really just one of the great figures in the city as an artist, as a man of genius, and as somebody who really in many ways kind of makes the city even more aware of itself. So I think the presence of the Gross Clinic in Philadelphia is something that will be sorely, sorely missed if it happens. And it's why it would be so fantastic if we can all find a way for it to stay here.
You say that it makes the city aware of itself, but 500 visitors last year, even if we assume that all of them were from Philadelphia, and I expect that they probably weren't, Philadelphians don't seem to have appreciated this work. It seems to have been one of the very well hidden treasures.
You know, I don't think of the Gross Clinic as a hidden treasure. Obviously, it would be fabulous to have it in a place in the city, in a number of places, where it could be, you know, seen by many, many more people on a daily basis. The Philadelphia Museum of Art, the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, the two places with which Aiken's has been so closely associated for so very long. These two institutions provide fantastic context for Aiken's, but you could say that so does the whole city. You can't watch the rowers on the Schuylkill River without thinking of a painting that's in our collection. You can't go to the orchestra and listen to great music without thinking of the painting of the cellist in the academy. He's everywhere, in a sense. And yet, this painting is in some ways a kind of triumph for the young Aikens that is like nothing else. It's a painting that's about a moment in time. It's a painting that's about a city. And it is a staggering work of art.
A staggering work of art with a staggering price tag, not to labor the point, but with so many arts organizations in the city barely getting by, if $68 million were to come from either the foundation community or from the philanthropic community in the area. I mean, is it a zero sum? If we spend $68 million on one single work of art, is that something that you think affects other smaller organizations?
Of course it's a huge sum of money, and it makes it a huge challenge for the city at a time when, you know, all the arts are flourishing, both the large institutions and the small institutions are striving to put themselves in the best shape that they can be for the future. And, you know, I think everyone is enormously mindful of the fact that it's a challenging time for all arts organizations, and everyone has a lot on their plate. And yet it's also a time when Philadelphia, in a sense, needs above all to shine. You know, it needs to be the place where people rejoice in the arts and what they mean for the city, what they mean for our visitors, what they mean for our children and our future.
Are you optimistic that this painting can remain in this area?
I think there's a lot of energy, and there's a lot of willpower out there, and a lot of ingenuity. You know, Philadelphia has an extraordinary record of doing remarkable things at remarkable times. And so I think Philadelphia, my sense is that Philadelphia will make a really great effort. I can't predict, but I'm an optimist.
Philadelphia Museum of Art Director Anne Darnancourt, optimistic that a way can be found to keep the Gross Clinic in Philadelphia. Yet the foundations and philanthropists who could potentially fund this purchase are already deeply committed to the broader arts landscape. We asked the Pew Charitable Trusts, who in 1998 shelled out $3.5 million to keep the Dream Garden in Philadelphia, to comment for this story. In lieu of an interview, they gave us this statement. Like many in Philadelphia, the Pew Charitable Trusts is shocked and saddened to learn that Thomas Aiken's painting, The Gross Clinic, may be leaving Philadelphia, the masterpiece's home since its creation here in 1875. Our city is blessed with some of the world's most important historic and cultural treasures, and the Aiken's painting is no exception. We take pride in our community's reputation for good stewardship of these works. The $68 million price tag to keep the painting in the city that inspired its creation is a high bar to reach in just a little over a month. I put it therefore to Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts Board Chair Don Caldwell that with a recent major expansion of PAFA and major renovations in the pipeline at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, potential funding sources for a project of this financial magnitude may already be tapped out.
It's certainly possible, but the hope on the part of all of us is that we will attract people that would not necessarily be the kind of people that would be leading the capital campaigns at the two institutions.
Is it possible that you can reframe this purchase, not being about the acquisition of a painting, but being about funding medical research and education?
Well, there's no question that there's a great many members of the medical profession that have not been necessarily traditional supporters of the fine arts institutions that would like to keep this extraordinary painting in Philadelphia. And I think there will be efforts made by members of the artistic community that wouldn't necessarily rally to support a physical building campaign.
You've just announced that you and the Philadelphia Museum of Art are not going to be in competition for this painting. If it were acquired, how would it be exhibited, or where would it be exhibited?
Sure. The painting is fragile. While Jefferson has done a wonderful job of caring for it, it has not been kept in museum conditions. It's one of the reasons why they think they should be selling it, and I concur with that. So it can't be cavalierly moved, but we could do something like 5 years here and 5 years there, and that'd be fine.
Obviously, Jefferson have been very intelligent about the way they've approached this as a business proposition, and that they've found a way to establish what the market value, at least the market value to a non-private collector is. Any criticism of the way that was approached, the fact that local institutions weren't in on that conversation?
No, there's no criticism. I think that it had to be done quietly, because otherwise, you know, they could have had so much uproar that nothing would have happened for years. And clearly there was a decision made that $68 million or some such number was very instrumental to them achieving their mission. So I have no criticism of the way they have gone about it. And I do appreciate the fact that they ended up with 45 days for the local institutions to come to the fore. I also appreciate the fact that there cannot be, you know, a $69 million bid come in from somebody in New York, private or otherwise. I appreciate the fact they didn't sort of leave it open for a bidding war now. The only people who can come forward are us. So, you know, would people love 90 days instead of 45 days? Sure, but if this is going to get done, I think we'll know a lot long before the remaining, I guess it's 39 days are left. And there's always things you can do at the end if you have to bridge a little bit. But I think that having time pressure is not bad.
What's your lay of the land now? Is it gonna stay? What's your feeling?
Well, there's some very important people important to this kind of effort who are very involved already. And there's money that has been pledged from sources that you would not expect, including one related to the medical profession. So we're accumulating what we call in the business world soft circles. And, you know, I think in the next 10 days or so, we'll have a much better indication.
Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts Board Chair Don Caldwell. PAFA and the Philadelphia Museum of Art have launched a public appeal called The Fund for Aiken's Masterpiece to raise funds to purchase the Gross Clinic. More information is available at philomuseum.org/keepaikens. philomuseum.org/KEEPEAKINS. If this appeal should fail to match the $68 million already on the table, the painting will leave Philadelphia. We'll keep you informed.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Throughout his career, 19th century German composer Jacques Offenbach wrote about 100 works for the stage, most of them lighthearted operettas. Offenbach is recognized as having pioneered this form, but the last project of his life was no little opera. Perhaps wanting to culminate his career on a more serious note, shortly before he died in 1880, Offenbach labored to compose a tragic grand opera, The Tales of Hoffmann. Because he wasn't able to complete the entire work, a friend and colleague had to put the finishing touches for its Paris premiere in 1881. After that world premiere, pieces of the opera's handwritten manuscripts were not returned to Offenbach's family, and much of the original score was eventually presumed lost. Lacking a clear sense of what Offenbach's intentions were for the opera, numerous versions of the Tales of Hoffmann have popped up over the last century. The contrasting editions have added music, cut music, and even altered the original story structure. During the past 20 years, however, some of the original manuscripts for Offenbach's composition have surfaced, shedding more light on the composer's vision for the Tales of Hoffmann. The most recent edition, which incorporates these rediscovered manuscripts, is being produced by Temple University Opera Theatre this weekend. As WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer reports, the Philadelphia production caps off a long process of research and reconstruction for Jack Offenbach's masterwork.
Tales of Hoffmann is based on three stories by the Romantic-era German writer E.T.A. Hoffmann. Hoffmann himself is the central character of the opera, which is essentially made up of five parts, a prologue, acts 1, 2, and 3, and an epilogue. Set in a tavern, Hoffmann, who's a poet, recounts the tales of his three great loves to his drinking companions. The first story, act 1, relives his delusional infatuation for Olympia. A pair of magic spectacles blind him to the fact that Olympia is actually not a woman, but a life-sized doll. The second tale centers on Hoffmann's fiancée, Antonia, an opera singer who suffers from tuberculosis. And the third story, Act 3, introduces the seductive Giulietta, a Venetian courtesan who manipulates Hoffman's lust. Tales of Hoffman Temple director Copeland Woodruff views these narratives as an exploration of the self-destructive nature of art. He observes that after Hoffman experiences the loss of love, the poet is challenged to use his pain to create poetry.
So to me, it's all about the artistic process and what we go through. We bring a part of ourselves, the pain, the happiness, all of it, and form it into some artistic work.
Woodruff's interpretation of and dedication to the tales of Hoffman is one reason the Washington, D.C.-based musicologist Michael Kay agreed to allow Temple University to stage his edition of the Offenbach opera, which was co-edited with French musicologist Jean-Christophe Keck. Woodruff's vision resonates with Kay, who began working on reconstructing what he views as the most authentic version of the opera nearly 20 years ago, after hundreds of pages of the original manuscript surfaced at a 1986 Sotheby's auction in London. An American collector purchased the autographed materials and allowed Michael Kay to see them.
I was working at the time to finalize the thematic catalog of Offenbach's works, so we had access to all of the known manuscripts in public and private collections. And when we saw the Hoffman manuscripts that were sold at Sotheby's, I realized that I was looking at something that had been totally unknown. The actual material that was rehearsed and performed, fully orchestrated, signed, sealed, and delivered by Jacques Offenbach for the world premiere. And the problem was, at that time, after Offenbach's death, the entire Giulietta act was cut from the score. So after studying the extent of these new pages, which were not available to any other editor, it was possible to see where they went and how they figured in the scope of things.
While the Giulietta act that Kay speaks of was not included in the 1881 premiere of the opera, subsequent editions did try to flesh out this component of the story. However, they positioned Giulietta in the second act, not the third, as Offenbach intended. In the early 1990s, another 24 pages of the manuscript emerged and were sold to a private collector in Paris. Michael Kay says these pages revealed even more details about the final scene of the crucial Giulietta act. With all the new discoveries from the original pages, which were by now scattered around the world, Kay felt compelled to incorporate all the new information into a new edition that was as true as possible to Offenbach's original intentions. Kay is passionate about this sort of authenticity.
As a student, I was very fortunate to work with Sarah Caldwell. And Sarah Caldwell was a producer in Boston who could only produce or conduct an opera when she had the actual composer's manuscript to study. And I thought that was normal. I thought that everyone would be interested to go back to what is called a fidelity to the work, faithfulness to the composer's intentions. To my surprise, over the years, this is not the case. In other words, celebrities of the day find it much easier to simply do that which is familiar to them. So while there have been great exceptions like Placido Domingo and others who have been faithful to the edition in interesting ways, it's always been a huge frustration to find major conductors who simply don't want to do the work that's necessary to understand the contents of the edition.
When the Temple University Opera Department decided to produce Tales of Hoffman, they didn't initially have plans to use the Michael Kay version. The opera was selected as part of a co-production with the Peabody Institute of Music in Baltimore. Temple Opera producer Jamie Johnson says the two institutions chose to pool resources for financial reasons.
We have two different directors working on this piece. We have two different musical directors, but the common elements are we built all the costumes and the set. So we've had production meetings and working amongst the two universities to share common elements, but yet the artistic freedoms amongst the universities are quite separate.
In fact, when Peabody presents their opera this spring, they will not be using the Michael Kay edition. But Temple opted to go with Kay's reconstructed edition based on director Copeland Woodruff's preference for the restored narrative structure. Regardless of what version either school is producing, all involved agree that Tales of Hoffman is an especially demanding opera.
It's probably among the five most ambitious projects that we've attempted in my 18 years here.
John Douglas is the music director of Temple Opera Theater and conductor of the Offenbach Opera.
Tales of Hoffman is not a show that you do in a student setting very often because there are a number of roles that have very exacting vocal demands, One of them is the title character Hoffman, which is a tenor role demanding tremendous stamina. I rarely have a student here capable of doing it, but I do have a doctoral student in Jun Yang, who is a wonderful tenor, and I've worked with him professionally as well as other roles and other operas here, so I knew him very well, knew that he could handle it.
The Temple Opera production marks the first time that Michael Kay's current edition will be performed in the United States. Kay says that for him, the Philadelphia show is essentially the end of a long journey. Based on the final proofs used and a double-checking for errors by Temple Opera, Kay's edition is expected to be published within the next year.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Temple University Opera Theatre's final performance of The Tales of Hoffman is at the Tomlinson Theatre at 13th and Norris Streets in Philadelphia tomorrow afternoon at 3. Once upon a time, movies were made in studios, and the phrase film competition meant the Oscars. With today's technology, movies are made just about anywhere, and film competitions are just about everywhere. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes a look at a brand new local film competition and explores the process of creating a new movie on the fly.
We're at a launch party for Project 21, a new film competition based in Philadelphia. There are filmmakers here, actors, camera people.
I'm Sean Adams. I do animation, storyboards, and a little bit of writing. Kind of here as freelance, just see if I can get on somebody's team or maybe even multiple teams.
My name is Bunker Seifert, and I'm the supposed team leader of Team Manlet. We're students from Drexel University, so we all got together, chipped in $20, and signed up. And we're pretty excited so far. We really have nothing prepared.
We are Team Go So No Productions. I'm Stephanie Okupniak.
I'm Ryan Leonard.
I'm Ben Vaughn.
Our leader and director of the film is Genevieve Okupniak. She is the Go in Go So No Productions.
We were kind of toiling around in our heads thinking about what could we get our hands on, and this just happened to pop up at exactly the right time.
Generally, we like to incorporate film and animation in most of our projects.
21 filmmaking teams have 21 days to make a film that's, well, up to 10 minutes long. Teams are allowed to scout out locations and line up cast and crew before tonight. But no one's supposed to start writing, rehearsing, shooting, or doing any of those other creative things you do when you make a film until the official start.
I am Joseph Torres. I am the team leader of Team Totorez. I am undertaking the incredibly insane task of making a cartoon in 21 days without sourcing my help to large factories of people. It's the information age, and things are supposed to be getting easier.
My name is Namdi Ejim. I'm with Team Leviathan. I'm already flirting with the absolutely ridiculously stupid idea of shooting on film. So if I'm going to do that, then I'm probably going to have to like stay as close to my apartment as possible so that I can sleep slash shoot slash cry myself to sleep. So yeah, I'll definitely be shooting in the Philadelphia area.
The start of the competition tonight will be signaled by the announcement of a secret element that every film must incorporate.
So, the element is 21. Now, 21 could be a person, a place, a thing, a concept.
And you're going to have 20 other teams also including the same thing in their film, so you want to be sure you do something original so it's not something somebody else also does.
So, make your Western comedy sci-fi in space if you want to.
That's Stephanie Juhas and Matt Conant, two filmmaker friends who came up with the idea for this competition.
A lot of people, once they graduate college, stop creating films because life gets in the way. Sometimes all you really need is a deadline, and the whole purpose is to give people a kick in the pants.
Stephanie is an animator, Matt, a live film action filmmaker. They figured together with their friend Kwang Lee, who is a composer, their combined contacts would be plenty.
That would complete the circle of filmmaking, and we could bring a lot of different crowds in and have them meet one another.
And so was born Project 21. It's different from other festivals that just call for completed entries because there's a competition attached. It's different from other competitions, like the 48-hour project or the 72-hour film festival, because of the 21 days filmmakers have to work.
And we said, we don't want to give them too much time because they'll just wait till the last minute. And we don't want to give them a small amount of time. We really wanted to make a film festival that would be animation friendly and special effects friendly.
Requiring that everyone incorporate a common element is a way to ensure that each film starts at the same time. But Juha says they consciously chose an element that would work in any context, so the films would stand alone and be usable for other purposes. The idea, she says, was not to dictate content or genre.
We already know we're going to get a couple comedies, we're going to get a couple documentaries, we have an experimental filmmaker, we have a lot of people blending live action and animation, which is fantastic, which is what we wanted. We have horror people. We don't want to force anyone to make a film they don't want to make. We just want to inspire them and motivate them to make the film that they've been meaning to make.
And filmmakers from as far away as California, Hawaii, and Japan were inspired. Word of the competition was spread by postings on the internet, as well as by old-fashioned flyers tacked up around Philadelphia. In keeping with the festival's name, 21 registrations were accepted. And so, at about 8:30 last Saturday, teams went out into the night, some to neighborhood cafes to plot, some back to their computers, all, no doubt, with their minds racing.
Trying to discover the most unique way to manipulate 21. We're actually right after this going over to Naked Chocolate around the corner to start brainstorming.
Well, the idea that's spinning around my head is sort of like a sci-fi drama type story.
We'll be spending the next few days up all night writing a script.
As of Thursday, 5 days later, embryonic films were in various stages of development. Team Gosono had lined up location, cast, and crew, and was, in its director's words, fiercely working on their script, which combined stop-motion animation and live action. Filmmakers in Team Manlet had their live-action film script written, equipment ready, and a nearly complete cast and crew. Waiting only for permission to film in a grocery store, they were planning a weekend shoot. Team Torres' animated film was set with idea and script. With storyboards almost complete and a final dialogue nearly recorded, Joe Torres and his newly formed crew plan to start animation today, which he says is the fun part. Meanwhile, festival producers Matt Conant, Stephanie Juhas, and Kwang Lee aren't just sitting around waiting. Aside from promotional activities, drumming up ticket sales for the screenings on December 4th and 5th, they're working on their own short film, a trailer to run as a bumper to each entry to tell the story of just what Project 21 is all about.
WRTI's Susan Lewis, who'll be checking back with all of those aspiring filmmakers in 2 weeks' time. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Norman Keyes, Dominic Mercier, Lawrence Saul, and Harriet Goodyear. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Greater Philadelphia Tourism Marketing Corporation, the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts, and the listeners of WRTI.